This is an ABC podcast.
Hello there. Welcome to the Religion and Ethics Report. It's Andrew West here on RN and podcast. We admire the smart, but what's the dark side of meritocracy?
It's funny because a meritocracy on face value actually seems really attractive. But if you look around and you don't see people like yourself that are valued and esteemed in everyday life, it's hard not to feel as though you're being looked down upon.
That's ahead on the show. And has right-wing populism waned in Germany? No jab, no entry. That's looking like the rule across much of Australia when pubs, clubs, cinemas and restaurants reopen after COVID lockdowns. But should the same rule apply to a place of worship? Anglican and Catholic archbishops support vaccination, but they say they simply can't turn away the unvaccinated. So how will the law deal with this problem? Sydney University law lecturer Joel Harrison is an expert in religious liberty.
What you have to assess is whether any limitation on somebody's exercise of religion, in this case, the association component, is, for example, rational. Is it necessary? Are there alternatives? Is the balance being right as between the liberty of, say, the group here and what they're trying to do in balance with the public interest, in this case, the public health interest? Those assessments are done, and they would be done in the New South Wales context, I think, still as a matter of political deliberation.
I know this is ultimately a political decision in a sense, but what if the priests or pastors or imams or rabbis were to simply turn a blind eye and not demand proof of vaccination at the door of their place of worship, and this ultimately ended up in court? How do you think that might play out? Would a court be reluctant in pursuing this?
I think it would just play out in the same way you have other conscientious objection cases. You know, you have cases where people chain themselves to trees and chain themselves in the context of mining and so on. And whether that first offending, you know, leads to actual sentencing and these sorts of things, I think the optics would be the fascinating point to what your question is raising here, because the law that potentially is being proposed downstream, and this is all uncertain, of course. We don't know what's going to happen in the context of this roadmap to freedom. So I don't think we should be hasty in making full assessments. But yes, if it's a case of what you're asking is that somebody would have to check the vaccination passport of a person, meaning presumably that fines could be imposed upon a church or people could be committed for an offence, or you have the optics of police entering into a church, middle of a service, after it, whatever it is, to check in fact that people have had their vaccine passports looked at. And I think those optics are going to be incredibly problematic if that's the state we actually get to.
Most religious congregations, as I understand them, have at the door of the church or the place of worship a volunteer, and they don't so much police entry as welcome entry. Who would actually be responsible if an unvaccinated person entered a church or the place of worship? Who would be responsible?
I think that's just a very uncertain question. Could it be the priest? Could it be, as you say, the person at the front? Could it be the parish council? Could it be the wardens of the church? That, I think, would be a matter of the internal polity of the church and how it organises their own authority. But that would be uncertain. Is there going to be a fine imposed upon these people? Or will it simply be, for example, the unvaccinated person who turns up at the church? Will they be committing a public health order offence?
The religious leaders who have written to the New South Wales government say that the service they're providing is not an entertainment, it's not a recreation, that for many people, religious observance is a necessity. In a legal situation, would that bolster their case?
So again, the legality of it is difficult because there's nothing to hook onto here, I don't think. There's nothing to say you've breached something like the Bill of Rights in the United States. Our free exercise clause in the Constitution is at the Commonwealth level only. So if we're dealing with New South Wales, again, these are going to be matters of political debate. And that's why you see this negotiation going on between the religious leaders. But let's take the Archbishop of Sydney, the Catholic Archbishop of Sydney, Anthony Fisher's statement that no one should be excluded from communion. Now, what does he mean by that? You know, he's saying that no one should be excluded from communion with God, the actual act of Eucharistic celebration, right? There, he's saying that actually that's at the heart of our religious liberty claim.
How do you think a court might look at it? Would they make the distinction between a religious service and going to see a band in a pub?
So say this did come before a court. Sometimes you see courts are a bit more open to what you could call the internal point of view, adopting an imaginative sympathy for what's going on. So they don't necessarily say, well, I'm a Catholic too, or I'm an Anglican too, and so therefore da-da-da-da-da. But they enter into what the religious group is actually saying, and so they understand the importance of what's being said. Now, that doesn't mean that the religious claim wins, as it were, because there could be competing interests that simply mean that the religious claim gives way. But in other instances, courts have actually been quite poor at this, and they show quite a lack of imaginative sympathy to the point that they see, for example, that they must hear the religious claim purely within a secular register. And so that turns something like Archbishop Fisher's statement about communion with God into more like a generalized, I want to associate with people in a very, you know, important way, but just generally associate with people.
Do we know how this issue of church closures or limitations on worship has been dealt with overseas in other jurisdictions?
Look, there's been multiple debates and claims around this. Lower courts in Scotland have referred to the European Convention on Human Rights and disproportionately limiting religious liberty by criminalising the meeting of churches during lockdowns. There was a lot of debate in Ireland around what some people were framing as banning the Eucharistic celebration. In the United States, there's been a lot of cases that came up during their lockdowns over whether it was unconstitutional to allow the opening of, say, shopping malls and cinemas while closing churches. And that was just a basic claim of equality. If you're going to allow the opening of some institutions, then you should allow reciprocally the opening up of religious organizations and so on, unless you could provide a rational reason for why those should be distinguished, right? But that's just a very thin claim of treating with equal treatment. Whereas what we're talking about now in the Australian context is the idea, the argument that, more like in that sort of Scottish one I said, that religious liberty is of supreme importance here and it should be treated differently for the reason that it's pursuing a higher good, like what Archbishop Anthony Fisher said, that communion with God.
Sydney University law lecturer Joel Harrison. Germans vote in national elections next week, and surprisingly, immigration is not a major issue. For a decade, it's ignited German politics, leading to a big vote in 2017 for the right-wing alternative for Deutschland Party. But talk about a new refugee surge out of Afghanistan has not moved voters. Professor Klaus Neumann is with the Hamburg Foundation for Research and Culture. Klaus, welcome. Why hasn't immigration flared up in the campaign?
Well, I don't think that many people in Germany expect that refugee outflow to reach Germany. I think the general expectation is that most Afghans fleeing their country will end up in Pakistan and Iran.
Is there not, though, some resonance of 2015? Because I noticed, for example, just a couple of weeks ago, the CDU candidate for the chancellorship, Armin Laschet, said 2015 should not be repeated.
Yeah, but he hasn't repeated that. And in fact, I watched the debate between the three main candidates, and the issue of refugees hardly came up. In fact, there was only one small reference to it when one of the journalists asking the questions asked Laschet whether he agreed that there should be a 250,000 limit to the number of asylum seekers that Germany accepts per year. That was something that the previous government had agreed on. And Laschet said there shouldn't be an upper limit for people seeking asylum. And Laschet has in fact been quite consistently since 2015, one of the strongest supporters of Merkel's asylum seeker policy. And because it was obvious that the two other candidates didn't have any issue with that, the journalists dropped the topic and moved on.
So, Klaus, how has the heat gone out of immigration as an issue just in the last 5 years?
Well, I think the heat went out at least a couple of years ago, if not earlier. In the last 18 months or so, the main topic has been Corona. That has pretty much replaced the refugee issue also as an issue that has been used by the far right. So I think that's one of the reasons. I mean, the fact that there are so few people coming now to Germany as refugees or as asylum seekers, that's probably the main reason why that's no longer a big issue.
Do you think that is likely then to be reflected in a diminishing vote for the Alternative for Deutschland, which is the right-wing nationalist party?
No, I think they will pretty much retain their share of the vote, and that's to do with their stance on Corona restrictions. So that's the only party in Germany that opposes the restrictions imposed by the state and federal governments. It's the only party that is very skeptical about vaccinations. And I think that will ensure that its previous vote is pretty much going to be maintained.
There was something quite unusual in German politics just a couple of weeks ago. There was an attack on the Catholic background and the Catholic association of the CDU candidate Armin Laschet. What was that about? Because it was, as I say, it was quite unusual.
Yes, it was very unusual. And it wasn't so much an attack on his background, but it was an attack on the views of his chief of staff, in fact. What happened was that at the campaign launch of the Social Democrats, they showed us a very short video clip which depicted Armin Laschet as a Matryoshka figure.
The Russian doll.
The Russian doll, that's right. So as that doll was unpacked, other figures appeared, and one of them was this chief of staff of Laschet, and he had in 2007 in a talk show on television said that he opposes premarital sex. You know, he has been known to have quite fundamentalist views on issues due to his particular brand of Christianity. But there were protests both from the Christian Democrats but also from some of the other politicians belonging to other parties, including the Greens. And the Social Democrats haven't used that video since. I mean, you are right to say that that is very unusual that somebody's religious affiliation features much in a campaign, at least now. I mean, it used to be the fact that, in the 1950s and 1960s, Catholic Germans tended to vote for the Christian Democrats, Protestant Germans tended to vote for the Social Democrats, but that's no longer the case. And prior to our conversation, I tried to find out what religion, what church the three main candidates actually belong to. I mean, with Laschet, it's very clear. I mean, he is a Catholic and he actually worked for a Catholic newspaper. But with the other two, I actually had to do a bit of a search to find out.
Criticizing Laschet's association with a conservative Catholic was called a taboo. I suppose I'm fascinated as to why a religious criticism would be a taboo, because when I look, for example, at world values studies of Germany, Germany comes up as a pretty liberal place. Why would criticizing someone for a conservative religion go down badly among the German population?
Partly because it wasn't really criticizing him. It was trying to get at him by criticizing somebody else. So I think that was considered to be quite uncalled for. I mean, I think if Laschet himself had voiced those views, then that would have been a different matter. But he clearly does not share those views. I mean, he is not a fundamentalist. And also, I think Germans are very careful not to mix politics and private life. Whether somebody goes to church on Sundays, that's considered to be her or his private matter rather than a matter of public concern.
There is some other interesting data that's quite recent from Pew Research from late 2019. It showed that in West Germany, the old West Germany, 60% of people still say that religion is very important or somewhat important to them. Why don't these values issues play a larger role then in German politics? Because that's a very significant number of people who identify with religion.
Well, I mean, that depends on what people who were asked by Pew Research, what they meant when they said religion is important to them. I mean, it could just be that they are Protestants or Catholics, that they pay 8 or 9% of their income tax, you know, for the church. And that's an important aspect of their life. Protestants tend to go to church maybe once or twice a year. I don't think it means that they're necessarily believers. I mean, I would be surprised if 60% of Germans considered themselves to be believers. For many, church is just, you know, a social context. In terms of values, ethical questions play a big role in the election campaign. Most importantly, the question of how the young generations are going to deal with climate change and how the, you know, over 50-year-olds or over 60-year-olds, the baby boomers, how they are responsible for problems that 20 and 30-year-olds are going to face in the future. So, I mean, that's sort of an ethical issue that is important in the campaign.
Professor Klaus Neumann, he's with Deakin University. He's also with the Hamburg Foundation for Research and Culture in Germany. Klaus, thank you for coming back to the Religion and Ethics Report.
You're welcome.
And you're with Andrew West. Meanwhile, Pope Francis has been in Hungary and Slovakia delivering a strong message about the plight of immigrants and refugees. In the presence of Hungary's nationalist leader, Viktor Orbán, Francis said the cross of Jesus, quote, raises and extends its arms to everyone. He also warned of the lingering anti-Semitism in Europe. Do you treat life as a contest, chasing top marks in everything, right down to that perfect reverse park when you're out for a drive? We'll meet Dr. Justine Toe. She's been reflecting on how this quest has shaped her life, but undermined her spiritually. Justine's new book is called Achievement Addiction, and I wanted to know just who are these achievement addicts?
Haha, you are speaking with one. An achievement addict is someone who thrives on achievement and it matters just a little bit too much to them. I would describe it in spiritual terms in some ways. It becomes the reason for your existence. It becomes the thing that can guarantee the success or the otherwise of your life. An achievement addict is someone who finds that their reason for living, pathetically enough, can come down to how good they are at a particular accomplishment, or if they can point to their resume and say, yes, these are the things that I've done and I'm justly proud of myself.
You've got a lot to be proud of, Justine. You've got a PhD. You've been a presenter here on the ABC. The thing, though, that did actually intrigue and amuse me was the way that you said you found achievement in the tiniest things, like being able to parallel park your car. I thought, okay, that is an obsession. Not happy with a PhD, you've got to parallel park that car properly.
Oh my goodness, how much time have we got to unfold this? The thing with the PhD is that I have found that in trying to pursue a doctorate, I'm kind of looking to certify something about myself, to prove something to myself as much as to other people. And I wrote 100,000 words in order to gain the credentials so I could write PhD at the end of my name. But it's really strange because even after writing those 100,000 words, the addition of three little letters to the end of my name does not necessarily make me feel like I have achieved anything significant. So this is why I think it's also an addiction, because it doesn't deliver on what it actually promises. I might have looked to my studies to prove that I'm clever, but it's very strange to wind up with that accolade and still feel incredibly insufficient or inadequate. It's very brutal in that sense.
The thing is, Justine, listening to you explain this so eloquently, I'm trying to work out what's wrong with it, why you have such a problem with this. Because good things, striving, effort, they all sound good things, don't they?
They are good things. And this is the thing. Like, I'm not trying to say that achievement doesn't matter. Of course it does. We have the economists who tell us that our future as a nation depends on our increasing productivity. So I'm not trying to slam achievement, but I'm just calling out our conflicted relationship with it. I know so many women like myself. It's like we've never left that classroom in a way. We always want to do our best. We try really hard and we can be quite down on ourselves when we don't get what we're going for. And so I think it's worth us just taking a step back from all of this and say, look, this has been wonderful to have, and to be able to get what you've been going for is great. But to be able to also be conscious of the, I would say, spiritual harms that are involved as well, I think it's wise to be aware of them and try and make space for that critique as well.
We are going to talk about some of those spiritual harms that you talk about. But look, there is a dark side to this achievement addiction, and you nail it here, and that is related to this idea of meritocracy. The British philosopher Michael Young came up with the idea of meritocracy, I think, in the 50s, and a lot of people, including me for several years, really misunderstood this. Why is the idea of meritocracy, the idea that society should be run by the smartest people, actually quite dystopian?
It's funny because a meritocracy on face value actually seems really attractive. I think that many of us would say that an aristocracy where someone is born to privilege, born to wealth, or might be the son of a king, that that person has done nothing to earn their position in life and earn their future success in life. Whereas a meritocracy, it's based on merit. It's based on people kind of working hard and earning their way in the world. Therefore, their success is entirely justified. But I think what Michael Young was finding about the meritocracy was that it was quite dystopian, because rather than having like a two-tier class system, I suppose, based on whether you're born to privilege or not, it actually then becomes supplanted by one caste of people who are the super high achievers, but then also an underclass of people who haven't tried as hard, perhaps, or that they tried and then they failed. He was saying that it actually means that inequality becomes justified because your underclass of aggrieved underachievers didn't do enough to make a success of themselves in life. People like Michael Sandel have pointed out that things like Brexit, things like the election of Donald Trump to the US presidency, have seemed to be roiled by a real split between those with university credentials, for example, and those without those. And so there's a real kind of like class warfare in some ways opening up between the deserving haves, the kind of meritocratic overachievers, and the undeserving have-nots. I mean, I don't think they're undeserving, but this is the kind of dynamic that gets set up.
Well, I think you actually say that it leads to a politics of humiliation.
Yeah, that's right. Because if you look around and you don't see yourself or people like yourself that are valued and esteemed in everyday life, then it's hard not to feel as though you're being looked down upon. So I single out The West Wing for criticism. Obviously, that show's been finished for a long time, but I think it does occupy a particularly hallowed place in the liberal imagination, as this is what politics should be like. This is what it means to be a well-educated, well-refined, well-rounded person in the world. And so you have to imagine, is someone who's never gone to university, if someone who works with their hands for a living, are they going to be able to look into that program and see something of themselves reflected back? Not quite. You just can't escape the idea that someone thinks that you're not good enough to rub shoulders with them. And I think that is a real problem because it destroys common bonds with each other. There's no way that you can recognize that we're all part of the same human tribe if these are the distinctions that we call upon in order to distinguish ourselves from each other.
You're a research fellow at the Centre for Public Christianity. This is not necessarily a Christian or religious book per se, but you do argue, Justine, that whether you're a believer or not, there's something in a particular Christian parable that is a corrective to this achievement addiction, to this dystopian idea of meritocracy. What is that parable?
Yeah, well, it's a story that Jesus told. It's commonly known as the parable of the workers in the field. And he tells this story about how the kingdom of heaven is kind of like this guy who goes out to hire laborers for the day, and he promises them a fair wage. But he continues throughout the day hiring new people, such that you've got people who've been there since, let's say, 6 a.m., and you've got people who've only joined the day of work at 5 o'clock, and knock-off time is 6 o'clock, let's say. But then at the end of the day, when everyone's lining up to get paid, everyone, no matter what time they started, gets the same pay. And so Jesus tells this story to be like, in the kingdom of God, how much you earn or how worthy you are of success doesn't seem to matter to God. what actually really matters is the generosity of the owner, right, of God in terms of the kingdom of heaven. And he will be generous to all regardless of merit. And this story has always provoked me because I want to be recognized for my success. And that success often is based on how others went when confronted with the same assessment. And so it's shocking for me to look at this and to go, oh, okay. So are you telling me that I have been a striver in all sorts of ways for most of my life, but are you telling me that in God's economy, this actually counts for nothing? That really helped me understand the substance of grace, I suppose, which is such a key Christian idea, that it's not dependent on what you deserve, but that grace is a loving movement towards the other person for their own good and regardless of whether or not they are worthy.
You've quoted the psychoanalyst Carl Jung, who basically says that addiction is another form of religion. You also refer to this thing called workism. Has that become an alternative form of religion for many people? Workism?
Yeah, I think it kind of has. Like, I'm not that familiar with it. Oh, I'm so sorry, Andrew. Caleb, Mummy's doing an interview. Could you go right now? I really need to get this done. Can you go that way? No, please don't sit down, honeys. Sweetheart? No. Can you please go? Thanks, honey. Okay, see, this is terrible, isn't it? I'm teaching him that he can
earn
success. But hey, good behavior means that you can have TV.
It's a perfect illustration of your point. Workism as a new religion.
Oh, that's right. Look, I think that the substance of what Carl Jung is talking about is that if you don't revolve your life around God, it's going to have to revolve around something else, right? And so for one person, like a former patient of his, alcohol was the solution to his spiritual thirst, let's say. And I think that for many of us, someone like me, I'm not addicted to substances, unless you count sugar. But beyond that, I'm addicted to achievement. And achievement has become that thing that has the kind of meaning and the significance of my life all wrapped up in it. And so, yeah, I think workists exist all the time. I live and work among workists. These are the kinds of people who often will never find themselves darkening the door of a church, but who express the same worshipfulness, let's say, and the same piety and the same sacrificial devotion to their work above plenty of other things that they could be devoting their lives to.
Dr. Justine Toe, she's a senior fellow at the Centre for Public Christianity. Her new book is called Achievement Addiction. Justine, thank you so much for being with us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Thanks, Andrew.
And that's the program for this week. Before we go, we report the death of one of the most fascinating and provocative Christians of the last 50 years. U.S. Episcopal Bishop John Spongers died aged 90. He was known for more than a dozen books, for questioning the doctrine of the virgin birth, and for supporting gay rights in the church. At our website, there's a link to an interview with Bishop Spong. Well, you can follow us at the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks to Hong Jiang, Simon Branthwaite, and Tim Jenkins. I'm Andrew West. The Religion and Ethics Report is back next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.